Good morning. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could be listening during this hour. American journalism has changed dramatically during the past 50 years. Many of those changes have been for the better, such as the general acceptance of high standards for accuracy in reporting. News reporters are also much better educated than in the fabled past. But despite the professionalization of journalists, many would argue that the news media has failed to serve our society in fundamental ways. Television, from which most Americans say they get most of their news, says it can bring us the world in 22 minutes, not counting commercials. Newspapers are increasingly operating as monopolies in many cities, with the result that readers have no alternative sources of area news. And the increasing concentration of ownership in media corporations leads to a tightening of control over what kinds of information will appear in the news. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who has long observed and reflected on many of these changes in American journalism. Ben Bagdikian is one of America's most honored journalists and editors, and one of the first to embrace the role of media critic. His career as a working journalist is too extensive, really, for me to do justice to here, but I'll just say it has included reporting from high and low places on poverty in America, the civil rights struggle, and various foreign wars. As editor for National News at the Washington Post, he was instrumental in publishing the Pentagon Papers at a time when the New York Times was stopped from doing so by a federal court. For many years, Mr. Bagdikian has also taught and served as dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, from which he retired in 1990. He is the author of a book many of you will be familiar with called The Media Monopoly, which reports on the concentration of media ownership and what that means for democracy. And he is the author of another book we'll be discussing here today entitled Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life, and Profession, published this summer by the Beacon Press out of Boston. As we talk, if you have questions, comments, those are welcome. You can join our conversation by calling us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, that is within the 217 area code, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line if you're calling from outside the 217 area code. You can use that. We'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. The numbers are similar, but not quite the same. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Mr. Bagdikian, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm delighted.
In Double Vision, your latest book, you refer to the radical transformation in the country's journalism and what this has meant, both good and bad, for our country. If I were a TV reporter, I might ask you to summarize in about 10 seconds what that transformation has been. But seriously, not to wax too nostalgic about the good old days, but let's talk a bit about where American journalism came from, starting from when you first came into the trade.
Well, I started a long time ago, the year before World War II. And for that year, and then after the war, for some time afterward, newspapers were the way they had been pretty much for 30 or 40 years, in which case one has to say that we had lots of practices that were considered standard and unchangeable in this institution of the press, what we used to call the press, and which have turned out to be quite changeable, and some of them necessary and good. 40 years ago, it was very common to use racial identification in crime stories when race had nothing to do with it. There were widespread standard use of sexist terms referring to women. If a woman was going to announce running for office, it would be saying that Sarah Jones, a shapely brunette, will run for office. And we never wrote that John Smith, a hulk with big shoulders, is going to run for office. There were girly pictures in every newsroom I ever worked in at that time that was used to titillate the boys in the back room. Some of them occasionally got into the paper. And the agenda of the papers was limited compared to what it is today. That is to say, most papers concern themselves with crime, court, and city hall, and foreign news was in most papers outside the biggest cities, and sometimes even in the biggest cities, was frivolous. Freak accidents and funny stories from abroad. And Now, that has changed, and much of it is better. Some of it is not. One of the things that was true before, when we had many papers in one city, a city of 200,000, for example, could have four daily papers. That's unheard of today. Now, those four daily papers went to different kinds of audiences. They separated them out. Some might have gone to, depending on the nature of the community, to conservatives, some to liberals, some to Catholics, some to Protestants, and so forth. And while each of them was limited, the total meant that information and ideas that were important to that particular part of the community got into the public discourse. Today, newspapers are technically and professionally much more sophisticated. Journalists are more sophisticated and have more disciplines than before. But most daily papers in metropolitan areas are keyed to the middle class, people with surplus income or who are seen as being good consumers, because most of a newspaper's revenue comes from advertising, and that's what the advertisers want. And in the result, that means that the lower increasing proportion of Americans, pretty much today the lower third, does not see a whole lot in their daily paper which is keyed to their interests. You see a great deal that is keyed to people with surplus income. We take for granted, for example, that a metropolitan paper will have a whole section on the financial world. And it's put together for corporate people and people with surplus income. And that's perfectly okay. But there's no counterpart section which is devoted solely to the needs of ordinary consumers, how to shop best for children's shoes and how to do the ordinary spending wisely and economically for the large mass of goods that the ordinary family has to buy. And in other ways, even though sexism has pretty much disappeared and racism has pretty much disappeared, all big pluses, there is a distinction between people who are affluent and people who are non-affluent, the working poor and so forth, who may appear with an occasional sympathetic story about an individual, but not in any fundamental way about those people as a group. During the 80s, we had this extraordinary social development in the United States in a decade which was being celebrated by lots of people, including most of the media, as a wonderful decade of prosperity. Suddenly, in the midst of this wonderful decade of prosperity, we saw families beginning to live in the street, something we hadn't seen since the worst of the Great Depression, and yet in the middle of this supposed big prosperity. Now, the newspapers did report on the homeless. They did have, and broadcasters did, and they had an occasional touching story about an individual. But they did not report why the homeless appeared at this time. Now, there were reasons for it, some of them very clear and very compelling, but those were not in the papers, with very few exceptions and never with any emphasis. We know that, for example, in 1980, where the government every year had been subsidizing 200,000 low-cost homes every year, that was cut to 27,000. So, obviously, that affected the homeless because people with low incomes could live in those subsidized rooms and houses. And when that subsidy ended, the middle class competed for those and the homeless were out in the street. Well, that was just one of many reasons that did not get in. I think there's a reason for it. One of the zones of silence, I think, in the media today, in the major media, is that if a social problem leads directly to the likelihood and necessity of increasing the progressive income tax, you do not see those things stressed. Now, I don't think there's any conspiracy. I think it is one of those conventions, one of those habits, which becomes built into our news reporting just the way the old sexism and racism used to be, and we just took it for granted. We over-report crime, for example, because the police do all the reporting. And we underreport the known causes of crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the known causes of crime are deteriorating neighborhoods, high unemployment, and so forth. And to correct that, and poor education in the districts that can least afford to have poor education. And the remedy for that, of course, is to rebuilding the infrastructure, rebuilding those neighborhoods with new, proper, low-cost housing, and in government as employer of last resort, and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that. And I think the reason, again, is that would point to the progressive income tax. I say the progressive income tax because what's happened is that, you know, when it comes to taxes, politicians are like the old-time policeman my uncle used to describe. In Cambridge, he found a dead horse on Massachusetts Avenue. But the policeman couldn't spell Massachusetts, so he dragged the horse around the corner to Main Street, which he could spell.
Right.
And politicians, when it comes to taxes, push it off on some other jurisdiction. Nobody loves taxes, politicians most of all. And so the feds push it onto the states push it onto the communities, and first thing you know, we have a regressive tax system, which is a sales tax, which hurts the average person in their disposable income the most. So the only rational answer to increasing our infrastructure, putting better, more money into education and so forth, rebuilding of rundown neighborhoods which produce all kinds of social pathology, is the progressive income tax. But that is, you'll almost see nothing in the major media pointing to that and even supporting it. So I think that there are weaknesses in our media today that did not exist before, while at the same time there are strengths. And I'm happy to have spent my career as a journalist. I would not want to do anything else, but I was always conscious of the fact that I was working in an imperfect profession.
You argue that there have been changes in the culture of reporting. You write that journalists move freely in the domains of power, but they're not supposed to take up residence. In other words, that they should maintain some kind of distance from the elites that they report on. It seems, though, that many reporters have moved out of the hood and into the wall complexes of the nation's elite, and maybe the identification of the values between journalists and those who they report is at the root of some of these failures or silences in the national press.
Yes, and I think that, you know, that's while many of our best stories have come from journalists who concern themselves with unfairness in society, and that I think most journalists inherently are sophisticated enough to know that that where the problems of society, the major problems of society may be, that there are other forces that work against that. For example, generally reporters give themselves a status depending upon the status of the people they interview. If you are a Washington correspondent who regularly covers the president, that's considered a very high value. But if you're a reporter who spends his or her time reporting on ordinary neighborhood people, that's not such a high value.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we, and because some of this is inevitable and necessary, reporters spend a lot of time talking to the people who have power. Now that's necessary. People who are powerful in politics, people who are powerful in corporate life are important because they affect what we do. But we don't do enough reporting on the effect on the average person of the decisions made by the power people.
Mm-hmm.
And in reporting, you get many more professional brownie points by being a reporter on the power people, the corporate heads, the governmental heads, than you do if you spend most of your time talking to people who are of modest income, ordinary people who are not household names. And most media are not so interested in that because names are attention getters. Just as in television, sex and violence are the cheapest, most reproducible, most easily exportable commodity, and therefore sex and violence consists, no matter how many people object, no matter how much public opinion surveys say the public's sick of it, they are cheap, profitable commodities because they freeze attention the minute you hit that button. So we have lots of sins in our heads, even though we can congratulate ourselves on having made many improvements. And part of the reason I call my book Double Vision was that reporters, all kinds of things. Reporters, for example, report according to what their editors tell them to do and according to the conventions of their trade. But when I look back, I realize much of what I did and what I noticed and what impressed me had to do not only with the conventions of my profession, but with the events of my life before I became a reporter. Mm-hmm. And so part of that is I was an Armenian born in Turkey during a massacre. I became very conscious of what the word ethnic cleansing meant and mm-hmm. what ethnic hostility meant. And while I never thought of it that way, I suppose that's why I found myself covering a lot of civil rights. And I think that everybody in the journalistic process, from the chairman of the board of Disney ABC to the reporter on the scene of an accident, is conditioned by their worldview, by their earlier experiences, by their values, their goals. And I don't think that's not changeable. That's inevitable. It's a human thing. And professional rules try to militate against unconscious influences that you can't control. But I would like to see more people from different walks of life involved, because one of the things that eliminated sexism from the Standard News was when women began to break the glass ceiling in newsrooms. And one of the things that began to make the system conscious of racist terms that they'd always used mm-hmm. was when minorities began to get into newsrooms. So I think that since we in the news business look out on the world and supposedly the whole world, we need a variety of points of view of the people who do it and backgrounds who will have varying sensitivities. And one of the reasons I'm concerned with the consolidation into a few huge corporations is that they tend to have the same goals and values, and that gets to be a kind of massive Johnny One Note in our mass media.
We're talking this morning, let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest, Ben Bagdikian. He's the author of the book we're discussing, Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life, and Profession. Longtime journalist, editor, and media critic, and teacher of journalism at the University of California. Also the author of a previous book many people will be familiar with, The Media Monopoly. And we're talking about some of the changes in American journalism over the past 50 or so years. If you have questions or comments you'd like to join the conversation, please do so by calling us in Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. And toll-free anywhere else you're listening, around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. There's so much I want to ask you about, but you're talking about the perspective of the people reporting the news based on their life experiences. And I'd like, you know, to ask you to talk a little bit about your own background, since you write in some personal detail about the massacre in Armenia that your family, I think, very miraculously escaped and found its way to the United States in the Boston area. Then the reaction of so-called white Americans to people like yourself, as you say, people like you, Armenians, were not considered part of the white mainstream, which seems, you know, 50 years later to seem incredible, but I suppose a lot of things seem incredible 50 years in perspective. Could you talk a little bit about how those experiences affected your outlook?
Well, I knew, as every Armenian does, that the Turkish government, mostly between 1915 and 1916, but going on until about the early 1920s, killed by deliberate plan half of existing Armenians, and as many as 1.5 million. It was the first recorded genocide of our century. And after initial horror in the Western world, that has sort of disappeared because Turkey became important, especially in the United States, as a military ally and so forth. My family was in the midst of that and miraculously did escape, although my mother subsequently died. But then we moved to a fairly typical New England town just north of Boston, and part of, like, another double vision, why I named the book that, was that while my father was a professional man, he was a clergyman, and we lived on the surface a respectable middle-class life. Mm-hmm. It was during the Great Depression when I was growing up, and a lot of middle-class families kept up a respectable front but were desperate inside the, economically inside the house. I remember one winter my father had to chop up a grand piano to keep the house, keep us from freezing. But on the outside, while I had, I did not have a horrible childhood. I had a very happy childhood in many ways. My playmates were perfectly ordinary, good, warm playmates. I didn't experience a great deal of prejudice within the school system. But I heard important people in town talking about the foreign element. And if your adults in your family spoke Armenian in the street, you winced. I used to say, "Pa, please not in the A&P." Because someone speaking a foreign language then was considered not a real American. And so that you realize that not just immigrants, but pretty much non-white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, Irish Catholics were subject to a good deal of prejudice. And certainly African Americans were, but so were Greeks, Italians, and so forth. And so that you had those double things, a childhood which among your playmates, for the most part, was perfectly normal, a sort of Norman Rockwell, Sad Evening Post-cover childhood, and a very, I don't complain about that, it was a very happy one. I had, while we, my father was a professional man, one of the warmest people in my childhood was my uncle, who was a mechanic and truck driver, and my grandfather. Even though my father was a Puritan, no smoking, no drinking, and so forth. My grandfather, I'd spend time with him every summer, and I'd help him make bathtub beer during Prohibition. So I had a kind of double vision that way, and grew up knowing working-class people intimately, the same way I knew respectable middle-class clergyman's life. And I think that, too, influenced me. And everybody, every human being has these conflicting influences in their life. But for a journalist, I think it in conditions, and I think enriches how they are going to see the world. I felt perfectly at home in the kitchens of steel workers when I was doing stories on unemployment, just as well as much as I felt perfectly at home talking to mayors, governors, presidents, in the sense that I had had enough experience, and of course, journalism offers you that license, so that you can live at several levels, you can observe at several levels. And one of the things, of course, that's extraordinary about journalism in the United States is you have a kind of license to go to places where ordinary people would not be permitted. Mm-hmm. And I think we don't take enough advantage of that. It's not true in most other countries, including other democracies. Mm-hmm. Where the reporter sort of automatically is given access to people of power. And I think we ought to use that more for more socially significant ways, not just out of for opinion, but in order to make clear to more people the sources of the circumstances of their life insofar as they're decided by the power people. But mostly we report the power people as heroes. Some of them are, and some of them are strictly non-heroes. Yet because they're big names, they tend to get glorified.
This morning, during this hour, Focus 580, we're talking with Ben Bagdikian, journalist, editor, media critic, and teacher of journalists. And we're talking about his book, Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life, and Profession, published this summer by the Beacon Press. And we're talking about some of the changes in American journalism. As we talk, we invite you into the conversation. We have two or three people waiting, and we welcome others. I'll mention the numbers again. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with the caller on line number one from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Is someone there? Line one?
Not me.
Oh, I think it is.
Am I on there?
Yes, you are.
I'm sorry. I thought I was waiting. During your opening, which I caught the first few minutes, and I have been off until just the last couple of minutes, you were talking about how, in your beginning days of journalism, the press seemed, or now that the press seemed to have tilted toward those with power and those with money and privilege, and then you were just talking about social stratification. My question would be, do you hold any water to the argument that many are making that instead of liberal, the press is conservative in the sense that it tends to support the status quo and support those, for lack of a better word, the rich and upper classes?
Well, I have to say that whenever I hear, which I do, as everybody does very often, that there is a liberal bias in our news media, I find it curious and amusing. Because if you look at the average newspaper, and you look at the average newscast, and if you make a list, in the case of newspapers, underline in one color, and those sources of the news who are power people, and those sources of the news who represent power people who represent established economics, established politics, and so forth, and existing economic values. And if you make a different distinction, a list of those who are quoted who represent the average family, the average consumer, and these could be spokespersons from Ralph Nader to the Consumer Federation and Common Cause, etc., you will find this overwhelming imbalance of the papers, the news, and the newscast reporting what the power people say things should be. And these power people overwhelmingly are for the status quo and for the corporate view of our economic scene. And therefore, if that's liberal bias, it seems to me very strange indeed. I think what conservatives, I think one, there's a reason for that, I think. Conservatives generally have a vision of what they see as the eternal verities of the past, and they're sure of that. Liberals, in general, are in favor of adjustments and change, and they're divided. And so when you report things, or if you represent a class of people who report occasionally the dysfunctions in society, this looks as though you're trying to rattle the status quo, whereas our whole political system is supposed to periodically rattle the status quo. In the media, that's regarded as a sin. And so since I've just said I think we do it too little, I'm always amused by this accusation.
May I ask one more question, please?
Go ahead.
There's a book called Unreliable Sources. I have mentioned it on this program before. I hope I don't sound like a broken record, which states essentially what you state. I think it carries it a little further. There's one very interesting section about drugs and then what I consider to be the real drug problem. And when you, as far as I know, I hear the figure from tobacco, 450,000 people die per year, about, you know, could be subject to argument. And alcohol, about 100,000, which would include maybe 25,000, approximately, one here is approximately half of all accidents are alcohol-related. And it shows that maybe 5,000 people die from hard drugs, which is terrible. I'm not denying there's a problem, but it's one of those things where, you know, you think that the real source of all of society's problems are drugs, but the problem is right in front of our eyes, and it seems like until very recently, the media has not come to the tobacco issue in full force, in my opinion.
Well, I think that's right. I think our reporting on the relationship between tobacco and health has greatly improved over 40 years ago, when it was where the Tobacco Institute was matched as of even as equal credibility with the Surgeon General of the United States and all the medical research. I agree with you, basically. I think tobacco, for example, is the only tobacco and its consequences, the only fatal disease we have which has huge advertising campaigns, and we've saw the recent shameful backing down of a couple of the networks.
Sure, the 60 Minutes incident.
Companies threatened them.
Yeah.
And even though television no longer carries tobacco ads, the tobacco companies have diversified into food companies and so forth that do advertise, and newspapers and the printed media have a lot of their advertising from tobacco. And the tobacco industry is not bashful about throwing its weight around. And it's, so we are, you know, we have made some gains in that way, but we still have a long way to go.
I don't want to make the callers wait too long, but just sort of a follow-up on the issue of how the media reports either health issues or corporate issues and so forth. As we saw 60 Minutes backing off on its interview with a ex-Brown & Williamson executive because of the possibility of being sued, not the actual threat, but, you know, the possibility of a threat, I suppose. And some people have pointed out that, you know, CBS is sort of has been in the middle of this possible merger with Westinghouse, and that legal complications could have further complicated that merger. You've written a great deal about concentration of ownership in media corporations and what that means for reporting. With all these mega media mergers going on, there seem to be, for many of us, concerns about conflicts of interest of that type. Dan Shore writes about RGR Nabisco recently buying a magazine called The Weekly Reader, a popular school children's weekly, and instantly the format of the magazine changed, and it started featuring tobacco-related articles, and even had Joe Camel making frequent appearances on the cover and so forth. It just seems kind of difficult to grasp the extent to which these sorts of conflicts of interest may be rearing their heads on a daily basis. And that seems very troubling and something that you've written a great deal about. I wonder what you think of the current sort of frenzy toward these huge, vertically integrated, so-called synergistic media corporations.
Well, if we just talk about the news and just forget for a moment another very important part of this, which is it's a combination, it's a collection of enormous economic power, which translates into enormous political power. Just as far as the news is concerned, as these mergers get larger and larger and larger with great multinational corporations, ever bigger, the news part of their ownership becomes a smaller and smaller part, and in their eyes, frequently a troublesome part. But the separation of the news operation from any structure which has any inherited or learned sense of responsibility about the news, but which is owned by a very distant giant corporation which is in the habit of turning all of its energies to promote itself, which is perfectly natural, mm-hmm. except when it comes to the news. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that worries me. The news becomes smaller and smaller as a part of the whole. And the other thing is that because these companies are so huge and are in so many industries, and so many of these industries are reported and should be reported in the news with some dispassion, they have great conflicts of interest. Now, Disney ABC, for example. Disney has had problems periodically within its corporation and problems with objections to locating theme parks and violation of environment and so forth. Now, is ABC and the papers it owns going to report those with any kind of balance? We don't know. One of the problems in that case is that where there isn't something done which is one-sided, the worst thing is nothing appears, so that it disappears off people's agenda, the public agenda, because that kind of thing isn't put in either out of self-censorship in the news section or punishment of someone who puts something in that offends the corporate office, and that's the last time that subject reappears.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another caller to talk with, so let's go ahead and talk with them. Line number 4 in Bement. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing? And it's good to talk to you, Dr. Bagdikian. You'd think these companies would give you a break on updating your books by not merging. They must be driving you nuts. And something that I'm particularly interested in, and that's the lack of reporting on labor issues and really workplace issues beyond how to suck up to the boss in the office. And one of the things that I see connected to that was your earlier discussion of the professionalization of the media. And it's when I was going to school and studying communications and then teaching communications as a graduate student, I noticed that the vast majority of students, in fact, maybe all of them, came from at least comfortable middle-class households, and their attitudes were that they were going to become professionals, more or less part of what Michael Lind and later Newsweek called the overclass. And I feel that the transition of media people in general from being, say, apprentice-type reporters actually working in the field, and where it's moved into schools of journalism, has helped isolate people who are becoming reporters and editors and so forth from the working class. And I don't know, there's something that I've always found pretty funny is that the best example to illustrate this that I can give people is I tell them to go to the video store and rent the movie Teacher's Pet, starring Clark Gable and Doris Day. I was wondering if you had any comments on the professionalization of media people and as it regards coverage of working class issues.
Yeah,
I'll let you talk.
First of all, you're quite right. This flood of new big mergers, it drives me nuts in the sense that I'm running out of filing space for updating my other book on media monopolies. And I agree with you that I think, and I have a section in my new book, Double Vision, on how unions and ordinary working people disappear in the news, except when there's an arrest or there's a conflict, a labor conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The reporting on unions has been one of the great pieces of imbalance in our news. On the professionalization of journalists, I agree with you that that's the case. Journalists are better educated, and they, even though starting journalists are paid very low salaries, eventually they are almost by nature middle class. Almost by the nature of their reporting, their professional contacts tend to be with power people. And in a perfectly human way, they socialize with people like themselves, college educated, seen as being professional, and so forth. But I don't think that it is inevitable that, and I think it is a great trap. I think you begin to see the world as seen by you and your friends.
Mm-hmm.
But the news is something separate. And I think that can be remedied, and it is remedied on a few papers, but all it takes is a consciousness at the top of the news organization that that is the case, because reporters don't report things that will not get in the paper. They don't report things that will not get in the air. They do report things that their editors assign and that are rewarded. And so all it takes is an enlightened leadership, enlightened people who run our news system, who say we're ignoring working people as a continuous, systematic part of our news. We need to reflect more of the needs and wants of people in the bottom third. Now, they don't do that for the reasons we've been talking about, so that I think that if they did that, the professionalization of individual journalists would not be a barrier. When, for example, in the Philadelphia Inquirer, two reporters, Bartlett and Steele, in 1986 did an analysis of how the tax bills then cheated ordinary people for the benefit of the rich, even though it was announced as the opposite. They won, they got had a bestseller book, they were rewarded with prizes and so forth, and so that can work. But what it takes is consciousness and social consciousness and balance at the top in assigning news. So I'm not so concerned with the professionalization. What I'm concerned with is it makes it that much easier to conform with what is the weakness at the top, which is looking at the world through the eyes of corporate people.
Well, our lines are all full. I'd love to follow up on that because you tell a very interesting story in your book about how you got into trouble because you wanted to, talk about forming a union once at the Providence Journal. And there's, it's instructive of the long hostility in newsrooms toward unions. which also you argue plays a part in lack of coverage of labor issues. Anyway, I guess maybe we'll leave it at that for now, since we're coming to our last maybe 5 or 6 minutes, and try to take some more callers, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay. We'll go next to line number one in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Ben, I'm a voice from your past, and I think our kids went to the same church school in Providence at the corner of Benefit and Benevolent. I have a question for you. Since you've taught so many years in the journalism department, what do you think is happening to the current grads? Are we training up the new Restons and Murrows and Bagdikians, or are a lot of them going into PR? Seems to me that I keep finding occasionally even a favorite journalist has gone to be a consultant and turns and grinds out political, good stories about candidates. What proportion of kids stay in journalism, and are they getting good training? I assume they are if you're teaching it, but talk about it.
I think that, there are a lot of journalism schools, and some are better than others. But my experience has been, and not just at the school where I taught, but in a lot of other ones, that journalists leave their training with different kinds of views than after they've been in the business for a while. I think that that's not the major problem. The major problem is if you want to stay in, everybody becomes socialized by their workplace. And it's the rules of the workplace that begin to change them. And what we are seeing, and because starting salaries of trained journalists who've gone through professional training beforehand are shamefully low, they have to sacrifice. And that's why we see that at a certain point, some of our best people leave. And when newspapers recently, major papers, offered buyouts in order to cut down their news staffs, they were shocked to find out that some of their best people took it. And so I think that there is a growing uneasiness within professional journalism and the standard media that that the future looks as though it's going to be so corporatized, and that there are more doubts today than in the past that they should stay in it. And I think news business needs to recognize that they're going down a blind alley where they're going to stop getting people with high values and high abilities if they, number one, don't pay them better, and number two, don't give them more rewarding assignments that reflect the real conditions in society.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, we just have about maybe 3 or 4 minutes left, and our lines are full, so I want to go ahead and try to include at least one more caller. Line number four in Chicago. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, and what a wonderful guest you have. I read your book, Double Vision, and the only complaint that I had was that it really wasn't long enough. I loved reading about your family, but I would have appreciated more chapters on your work experience, because when you wrote about the Pentagon Papers, it was very exciting.
Well, I have to agree with you that it would have been better if I'd done a conventional biography, but I wanted to talk about the evolution of journalism at the same time. But it's very rewarding for any author to have a reader say, I wish your book had been longer. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Yeah, there's some stories that you allude to, an episode where you had yourself checked into a prison to report from there that I think there's one sentence on. And also you're reporting on the civil rights struggles in the 60s. I think there's probably at least a book-length treatment of that.
Well, I must say that I began with a feeling, I don't want to do another journalistic book on war stories.
Okay.
I ended up telling a few, but that was probably a mistake because, you think that you've done these stories and so everybody has seen it, but the fact is everybody hasn't. It's just the people who may have read it in the paper you worked for.
Okay. Well, we're just about here at the end of the time, and I'm sorry to say we've got a couple callers we're not going to be able to take because we would run out over our time if we did. Just to sort of wrap things up, there's a whole bunch here that I think is very interesting to talk about, and I would sure encourage people to look at the book if they're interested. In 1988, you experienced a heart attack, and you say this experience gave you a clear sense of priorities in life, something you wish could be shared broadly by the news profession. You wish journalists not a heart attack, but an attack of heart, as you put it. In this very confusing and fast-paced time, with all the pressures of working for larger and larger corporations with their own agendas and motives for power and profit, How can lowly journalists resist being co-opted by the forces of the marketplace, which seem to dictate so much these days?
They have to fight for what they see as necessary and legitimate news that is not being covered. And they have to fight within newsrooms because it's not a hopeless battle. Sometimes, most of the time, it will not make a big change, but sometimes it will. And I think it puts an unfair burden on the working journalists, but I think that's the only way, plus readers who know these things, to respond to their news corporation and let them know that there are people who are not happy with the product. And I wish, and then bring back in broadcasting, the requirement for public service, fairness doctrine, and things like that, which would have produced a much better quality representative broadcasting than we have today.
Okay, and lastly, is there going to be a new edition of the Media Monopoly coming out soon?
There will, probably in another year, because the scene is going so fast it's a running target, but there will be a new edition.
This would be, what, the fifth edition?
Fifth edition.
Okay. Well, we can look for that, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk with you about that in the future.
Well, I hope so.
Okay. I want to thank you very much. Ben Bagdikian has been our guest. Thank you very much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure.
Ben Bagdikian, author of The Media Monopoly. There are four editions in print, and also a book that we've been discussing entitled Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life, and Profession, published this summer by the Beacon Press. And certainly if you're interested in the topic, you should look for the book.